Okay, next case for argument, United States v. Parks. Ms. Pollack?
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Pollack. I am with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I have been appointed to represent Mr. Parks in this appeal after he was convicted by a jury in the Northern District of Illinois. The only issue on this appeal is one of the most difficult ones for any defendant in this court, and that is whether or not there was sufficient evidence to sustain his conviction. It is the most burdensome standard of review that a defendant can face. However, given the facts in this case, a review by this court is warranted, and those facts are, first and foremost, that the entire case was based solely upon the testimony of one witness, the only eyewitness, who happens to be a Chicago police officer. And second, and importantly for Mr. Parks, is that it took a jury two times to convict him. He had a mistrial after almost 3 days of deliberation in the first case, and then he was retried and convicted in the second case. And the main issue with the testimony of Officer Mandeel, who was the eyewitness Chicago police officer, who says that he saw Mr. Parks throw a gun away, is just the simple implausibility of that factual scenario. And when you look at what he said, putting aside the inconsistencies of his testimony, there were several factual inconsistencies between a statement that he had made to FBI agents in preparing the case and his testimony of the first trial and his testimony of the second trial.
Now, did he acknowledge that as his statement, that this was what we call a statement?
Yes, he did. He said it was his statement, but
he signed it and said, I agree with that, how that's written and all.
Well, I don't know if he signed it or not, but he did say on cross-examination that he did make a statement to those officers, to those agents, and he did say, yes, I made that statement. But what he said on cross-examination was that although the statement was what it was and it was his statement, he disagreed with a couple of the things that were in that statement. So he denied making portions of that statement and then refused to look at the statement on cross-examination to have his recollection refreshed.
It sounds more like a memo that an agent made reporting what the agent thought the agent heard during an interview.
Well, I don't think it was a statement. I don't think it was a 302. It definitely was not a handwritten statement by the officer. It was a summary of the officer's statement to the agent.
Right.
And whether he signed it or not, I'm not sure. I was unable to see the original.
Right. All of this was brought out on cross-examination.
Yes,
all of these inconsistencies.
That's correct. And you know, the inconsistencies.
Why didn't what he said on the phone nail him?
Well, because the first thing he said on the phone was, they lied on me at my preliminary hearing.
He said there are no prints on the gun.
He said there's no prints on that gun of mine, meaning the gun in my case. And I don't think that's dispositive that he possessed that weapon. I think what he was telling his wife was, look, I got this case and there's no prints on that gun. It's not mine in that case. So I don't think that's dispositive. It could be interpreted either way. And the first thing he said in that recorded phone call was, I didn't do it. It wasn't me. And so you can take that for what it is. What the jury was able to hear was, he says, it's not mine. They lied on me at the preliminary hearing, and there aren't even any prints on that gun, so they can't prove it anyway. I think that's what he said. And
how would he know there are no prints on the gun?
Because he didn't touch it. That's what he was saying, is that he didn't possess it.
Someone else's prints on it.
It could be anybody's prints, but it's certainly not
his.
But
he didn't say that. He said there are no prints on the gun, which means it's his gun. He knows there are no prints on it.
Well, I think you could interpret that either way. However,
well, if you can interpret it either way, then his conviction stands.
That's one piece of evidence that is not even the most important thing that happened here. That call was a tiny portion of the transcript.
Well, what do you regard as the strongest evidence of his innocence?
The fact that in order to believe the testimony of the officer in this case, you would have to believe that he was walking down an alley facing away from a car that had no sirens on, that did not have its lights activated, meaning he didn't see it. Then, magically, he exits the alley, crouches behind a vehicle, waits until officers are between 2 to 7 feet away from him, pulls a gun out of his pocket, and throws it on the ground in front of them. And that is an implausible factual scenario.
And it's not physically impossible, right?
Well, it's not physically impossible, but that's not the only thing that it could be. It could be exceedingly improbable as well. And I think that that's exceedingly improbable.
Now, who does he think dropped the gun?
He doesn't know who dropped the gun. It could be anyone. It could have been on the street. It could have been in a different location. The gun wasn't his, and that's all that he was concerned about. And that's why he took it to trial twice. And when you look at somebody of his experience...
Are you suggesting that anytime there's a hung jury that means there was weak evidence?
No, not every time, but it certainly merits a more careful review when a jury deliberated for 3 days and couldn't reach an agreement.
But all the careful review reveals is that it's a close case.
It's a very, very difficult case for any defendant to make. However, there is something to be said for that fact, and so that's why we're here today. Yes, I completely acknowledge the standard is the most exceedingly difficult standard of review in this court that is possible, and it may not be a case that this court elects to reverse, but it was not a frivolous case given the circumstances, given the clearly improbable nature of the factual scenario, and it definitely merited review.
But I don't know, what would we say if we reversed?
That in your experience, having reviewed other cases and in general knowledge, just because you're a police officer doesn't mean that you are infallible or honest, and that given what it would take a rational person to believe that this gentleman with a criminal history who had experience with the judicial system and had pled guilty in cases where he was in fact guilty, then walked onto a street next to an officer and showed them and handed them a weapon. That's basically what it says.
Sounds like we become jurors and we get information that even jurors don't get about how he pled to cases where he felt he was guilty.
Well, that's not in the record. So you can even removing that, you would still have to believe that somebody who was a felon, that's in the record, walked up to a police officer and threw a gun at his feet.
Well, you know, it could be that if a person had been arrested a number of times before and they had a gun on their person and they thought they were about to get arrested again, they might want to get the gun off their person before they get frisked.
Absolutely. And if he had the wherewithal to hide from the police officers, there was an entire alleyway behind him with garbage cans, doorways, and any other number of places where he could have stashed it. There's nothing saying that a person that it's even possible that this guy would have walked up to an officer and ditched it. So it's
really weak. Because this fellow, once he realizes there's a policeman behind him, he's not necessarily going to pick the most sensible way of trying to elude the officer's clutches, right?
Well,
so
I would
maybe
think
say,
that
I better get rid of this gun and just drop it.
He could have run away or
he could have done all those things. But there's no basis for thinking that your version is any more plausible than the police officers.
And yet, it is our duty to continue to represent these clients as they wish, and in a non-frivolous action, that's what we've done. So based on the argument in the brief, we would simply request that the case be remanded and that the jury verdict be overturned. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So, Ms. Greenwald?
Good morning, Your Honors. Helene Greenwald on behalf of the United States. As counsel has acknowledged, the standard of review here is very unfavorable to the defendant. This court views the evidence in the light most favorable to the guilty verdict, and the credibility determinations of a jury are to be accorded the utmost deference. And here the defendant's arguing that this case qualifies as one of the very rare, exceptional cases where a witness's testimony is so implausible that it can't be trusted as a matter of law. And on that basis, the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law. In addition to the fact that, as Your Honors noted, the officer's testimony was corroborated, not only by the tape recording conversation, which when viewed in the light most favorable to the government, does amount to an admission. And when counsel, I think, misspoke, there's nothing in the phone call where the defendant is saying it wasn't me or I didn't have that gun. What he says is that gun of mine basically has no prints on it. So that viewed in the light most favorable to the government, to the guilty verdict, as well as the corroboration of other points of his testimony, certainly support the verdict. But the things that the defendant is pointing to as calling the credibility determination of the jury into question do not rise to the level of being able to do that. In order to prevail on this, the defendant has the burden of showing that it was either physically impossible for the witness to observe that which he claims to have observed, or impossible under the laws of nature for the occurrence to have taken place at all. This court is clear inconsistencies, even if they were troubling, in a witness's prior statements or even conflicts with other witnesses, do not rise to that level. And in this case, as I think Your Honor noted, this was not a signed or even adopted statement by this witness. This was a summary. There's a stipulation that this was a summary interview taken by an ATF agent who interviewed the officer. And the officer never reviewed or adopted this statement. The officer had been shown the statement at the first trial. So when he says at the second trial, it doesn't help to refresh my recollection. The jury may not have known that he was shown it at the first time, but certainly the record shows it couldn't refresh his recollection.
The first jury was out a long time.
Pardon me?
The first jury was out a long time.
I believe it was, Your Honor.
And the second jury, how long was it?
You know what? I'm not sure. I do not know. But I do not think it went into, I'm pretty positive it didn't go into the second day at all. And in any event, inconsistencies cannot rise to that level, nor can arguments about improbability. In fact, this court most recently said in Benson versus Altamirano that suspects can react to the unexpected arrival of police in various ways, including not rational ways. And in that case, most recently, although there are other cases as well, found that argument completely insufficient to make this that unusual case where the jury's credibility determinations should be called into question. And finally, I'd just like to point out, as it is in our brief, that the judge who had the opportunity to hear the officer's testimony, observe his demeanor, repeatedly found the officer to be credible at the suppression hearing, at the denial of the post-trial motions, and at sentencing, where a enhancement was applied to the defendant for lying under oath during the suppression hearing when he claimed that the officer planted the gun. So this is not an exceptional case where the jury's determinations of credibility should be called into question. And for the reasons presented here as well as in our brief, we would respectfully request that this court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant, unless there are any other questions.
What is the
yes, Your Honor.
Plaintiff? I'll ask her, but I'll ask you first. She refers to the government's redacted version of the conversation, this phone conversation, along with stipulated portions added by the defendant. What does stipulated portions mean?
So what it was is the government had wanted to play basically the part of the conversation that discussed the son having a gun and him telling his ex-wife to tell the son to get rid of the gun, and then it leads into him saying information about how there's no fingerprints on that gun of mine. There was a later part in the conversation when he's talking about, this is while his case is still pending in state court, and there's a later part of the conversation where he's talking about his case having his lawyer get the case thrown out at the preliminary hearing stage in state court, and he says in the context of the state court preliminary, his lawyer cross-examining the witnesses and the police officer there, he says, the way it reads in the transcript is, man, this ma, unintelligible, is shit up. He says, when you listen to that tape, and actually we've introduced the tape into the record in the Court of Appeals, the actual tape, when you listen to that, the government's position was that's unintelligible. The defendant's position was that what he's saying there is that this man is making shit up, that the officer was lying about this.
Was it played to the jury?
It was played to the jury, and they made that argument. So this was all presented. But again, viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the government, that's not what the jury found, that the officer was making this up, but rather that the officer was telling the truth. Does that answer that? So then we would continue to rest on our brief as well as our argument presented this morning and ask you to affirm the district court's the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Greenwald. So, Ms. Paula, do you have anything further?
After rebuttal, if you'd like to ask me some additional questions.
No. Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank the defenders for their efforts on behalf of their client. And we thank Ms. Greenwald as well, and the court will stand in recess.